This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Commonweal on May 24th, 2006 at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time.
And Liz Armstrong just got through.
Well, Mr. Lerner, all the speakers are ready, so you can proceed when ready.
Okay.
We're joining the lines of monitor now, so it should be just a moment. Mr. Lerner, all lines are now listen only. You may proceed when ready.
Thank you very much. Eleni, are you on and ready to introduce us all?
Yep, I hopefully folks can hear me. Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome everyone to the call. My name is Eleni Sotos, and I'd like to welcome you to today's teleconference titled Invisible Signals, the Emerging Science of Electromagnetic Radiation. The mic pertaining to this call, including a new live weblog function and online resources relevant to today's topic. The live blog is available for call participants to post comments and questions during today's call, and no special software other than a connection to the internet is required. If you want to access the blog where you can ask questions or make comments that we can field and ask the presenters after their presentations are over, you go to our website, which is www.healthandenvironment.org. Once you get to the homepage, on the left-hand side of your screen, click on the first item under the What's New box that announces this call. And then once you click on that, it will take you to the page containing the blog link and reference materials. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some important logistical information regarding the call. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our guest speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all of the lines so that you may participate in the question and answer period if you choose. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, please identify yourself before you speak and please keep your comments or question brief. Note that the call will last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available on the CHE website for download within the next week or so. I'd also like to note that next month's National Partnership Call will focus on the green economy. We will be sending out specifics on the date and time of this call over the coming weeks. I'd now like to turn the call over to Michael Lerner. Michael?
Thank you, Eleni, and welcome to the partners from Brussels, where I'm in the office of the environmental EPHA Environment Network, which is a wonderful organization in Europe, doing very much the same kind of work that the Collaborative does. So we're grateful for their hospitality and grateful to have a really remarkable set of speakers and colleagues from Europe, Israel, and the United States involved in this call today. One of the things that's very clear when you spend, as I have, 4 or 5 weeks in Europe, is that the issue of electromagnetic fields has far higher salience here than it does in the United States. So it's particularly appropriate that we have colleagues on this call from Europe and Israel as well as the United States. Our four presenters today include Dr. Raymond Neutra, Chief of the Division of Environmental and Occupational Disease Control, California Department of Health Services, Environmental Health Investigations Branch, Dr. Michael Kundi, Professor at the Institute of Environmental Health at the Center for Public Health at the University of Vienna, Dr. Louis Schlesen, editor of the really extraordinary resource in the field, Microwave News. It's the place I go to get my information on this, and Cindy Sage, very valued, longtime CHE partner, and principal of Sage Associates Environmental Consultants. Welcome to you all. And I also welcome Professor Elihu Richter of Hebrew University, Hadassah School of Public Health and Community Medicine, the Unit of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, who will be making a first comment at the end of the speaker presentation. Our first speaker is Dr. Raymond Neutra. Dr. Neutra.
Thank you. And I'd like everybody to get their pencils out, because in a minute I'm going to give you a website that will give you a background for what I'm going to try to do in 5 minutes, which is to summarize 8 years of a $7 million project on policy with regard to power frequency electric and magnetic fields. It was something that was paid for by California ratepayers and was guided by a very active stakeholders advisory group. And what our project asks, and so the website is www.dhs.ca.gov/EHIB/EMF. So dhs.ca.gov/EHIB/EMF, and you'll find all the things that I'm talking about. What could we do about 60-cycle electric and magnetic fields from power lines and houses and workplaces and schools if we decided they were a problem? So we were doing precautionary policy exploration. And how certain must we be of how much ill health before we would move to cheap or expensive measures there? Now, what we learned in the course of this project was that the answer depends not only on the interests of the people who are giving the response to that question. For example, the stockholders in a for-profit utility company would have one set of interests, and the people living alongside a transmission line would have another. But also, importantly, on ethical world views. People that are concerned about the most good for the most people at the least cost will try to use a cost-benefit approach to answering that question. The people who feel that you have a duty to the people that are at extra risk financial costs are not so salient would spend a lot more, even though they agreed on all the facts. And the libertarians would say, look, don't impose any fees on me, don't impose any regulations, just give me information so that each individual can make their own decision. And there will be deep policy disagreements on those ideological bases. And it's important that we recognize that because ultimately that gets resolved, as do the interest differences in the political process. Now, so we had to package our degree of certainty that there was a hazard in a way that accommodated these different ways of looking at things. And simply saying, I'm either, yes, I am virtually certain that it's a problem, or no, I'm not virtually certain that it's a problem, is as cumbersome and not helpful as in a law case might be if you had a civil suit and the judge asked the jury to give a judgment, and instead of giving whether it was more likely than not, they only would answer whether it was beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the standard for criminal cases. So what we did was express ourselves as saying that either we were virtually certain it was a problem, we strongly believed it was a problem, we were prone to believe that it was a problem, we were close to the dividing line, we were prone to believe it wasn't, we strongly believed it wasn't a problem, or we were virtually certain it wasn't a problem. And we assigned boundaries to those categories in an explicit way. And then we tried to be transparent for the reasons that we had for developing that degree of certainty. We tried to express where we were before we started looking at the research, noting that some of the physicists were virtually certain that it couldn't be a problem, and so that any evidence would have to be very strong to move them from that. We looked at five streams of evidence. The evidence about the physical induction mechanism, that is, how does the magnetic field produce some kind of a chemical change? Then, what is the evidence that the magnetic field can produce a molecular change or a cellular change? Or what is the evidence that it can cause a change in the physiology of a whole animal or a human? And if you expose animals in a toxicological mode to these fields, Does it produce some kind of frank disease? And finally, what does the epidemiology say? And what we found was that reasonable people use different rules of thumb for combining this kind of evidence, and that's why they come up with different answers. There's a tendency, by the way, that each discipline puts a lot of weight on their own little area, and if they're not convinced of their own little area, they tend to discount everybody else's evidence. So we looked at the evidence, and in summary, we thought that the physical induction mechanism evidence, the cellular and molecular biology evidence, the physiological and the toxicological evidence were rather inconsistent as we looked at it. But we saw that there was a general pattern to the epidemiology in for a number of diseases. And because we believed there were some reasons why that other evidence could have been inconsistent, because we were testing...
Excuse me, Ray, you're at about 5 minutes now.
Yeah, I'm 1 minute to go. What's coming off of power lines is a complex mixture, something like coffee. And coffee might be a problem, but caffeine might not be. So that if you do a bunch of tests on one ingredient of a mixture and get inconsistent results, it doesn't mean that the mixture itself might not be a problem. So we gave more weight to the epidemiology than some other reviewers at the IARC, International Agency for Research in Cancer, and the British and so forth. But we agreed with them, particularly with regard to childhood leukemia, and we ranged somewhere from close to the dividing line to strongly believe that childhood leukemia, adult brain cancer, Lou Gehrig's disease, and spontaneous abortion, that EMFs could cause some degree of increased risk. And you can see all of that and much more at that website.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nitro. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Kundi. Dr. Kundi.
Yes, hello, everybody. My task is to speak about RF fields, that is radio frequency or radiation fields, and I maybe start by defining these fields. These are electromagnetic waves in the frequency range between about 30 kilohertz, that is 30,000 cycles per second, up to 300 gigahertz, that is 300 billion cycles per second. Although there are natural sources of these fields, by far more important and intensive are the man-made sources of radio frequency fields. And this whole area have many applications like radio or television broadcasting, telecommunication, mobile phones, but also microwave ovens or RF heaters, diathermia devices, and many other applications. And this had led to a widespread exposure of humans during the past 100 years or so. Since we have now more than 100 years of exposure, you may ask, haven't we enough evidence for potential health effects of these exposures? There are, if you look into the internet or in other media, you will find statements like there are 20,000 scientific studies on this topic. And if you look into the detail, then you must say that such statements are completely unfounded. First of all, there are only several hundred of these studies that deal or focus on health effects. And on the other side, the majority of these studies is dealing with very high exposures that are not of importance in environmental exposures. And third, it is wrong that these studies don't show any health-relevant effects. So it may be interesting to note that already in the 1950s there were voices about a possible link between RF exposure and cancer, but the first epidemiological studies were published in the 1980s, so 30 years later. And the first study ever published in epidemiological study was the so-called Korean War veteran study by Robinette and colleagues, and also the study by Sam Milham some years later on radio amateurs. And what is interesting is that both of these early studies found some indication of a link between RF exposure and leukemia. In total, I have 25 epidemiological studies in my file between 1980 and 2000. And most of these studies, although they have some methodological limitations, many of these studies at least show some evidence for an association between RF exposure and cancer. But what happened afterwards? You know, in the 1990s, there started almost a revolution. The mobile telecommunication industry had its exponential growth phase. And during this time, there was some consideration about this source of exposure, because nobody had ever dreamed of the possibility that billions of people will start to frequently hold a microwave source to their heads, and a quite powerful one also. So therefore, a certain uneasiness arose in the public health community, and many asked for sound epidemiologic and experimental evidence to strengthen the assumption that these exposures are safe. And from 2000 onwards, almost all studies of RF fields and health are about mobile phones. And, you know, if you're holding a mobile phone to your head, most of the exposure gets into the head. So the target of the studies was were tumors in the head area, intracranial tumors, mostly brain tumors. And during this time, from 2000 onwards, there are 17 epidemiological studies that have been published about mobile phones and brain tumors, and a few about other diseases. But in contrast to the expectations of the majority of scientists, these studies cannot support the view that these exposures are safe, actually. On the other hand, it is too early to say with a sufficient degree of certainty that there is actually an association between exposure to microwaves from mobile phones and brain tumors or other diseases. At the moment, however, the evidence rather points to an association, and therefore many scientists support the precautionary policy and the prudent use of mobile phones. So maybe I'll stop here and leave the topic to Louis and Cindy.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kundi. And now Dr. Louis Schlesen of Microwave News. Dr. Schlesen.
Thank you. I'm going to talk a bit about the politics in the U.S. and other places around the world, but let me start with the United States, where I guess I would put it that the U.S. government is terrified by this issue and would just wish it would go away. Basically, in this country, we have stopped doing research of any kind, except for the industry and the military, and EPRI, the Electric Power Research Institute, continues to have a small program. But it's really directed in protecting the industry. And the military is divided because it is also developing weapons to use as radiation, especially the RF radiation, to for crowd control and other uses. 7 years ago, the FDA, which has a responsibility for regulating cell phone radiation, tried to punt this over to the National Toxicology Program and proposed some large-scale animal studies be done. It was a good, you know, NTP has taken it very seriously, but unfortunately, 7 years later, not a single experiment is yet underway, and there are some plans, but at the moment, nothing is happening. In terms of exposure standards in the United States, we don't have any. Some states have some power line standards, but that's about it, and those are relatively high in terms of the level of protection. They don't really offer any protection in terms of chronic long-term risks. So in this country, you know, there is very little going on. And the real problem, in my mind, is that there is no balancing interest to argue the precautionary case. Basically, there are no national labor, consumer, or environmental groups that follow this issue or that speak out on this issue. For instance, Consumers Union, the publisher of Consumer Reports, is basically staying on the sidelines. They do not think this is a problem. They're much more interested in telling you which mobile phone plan is the most cost-effective than talking to anybody about health. Most in labor, we want to talk about occupational risks. Labor is essentially silent. Also, most of the activity on the citizen front is what I would call kind of NIMBY-esque. That is, you know, it's fighting a specific power line or a cell tower, but you know, it is very focused on one particular issue. The one possible exception is the EMR Policy Institute. Out of Vermont, and they have, you know, brought some cases to the SEC and to the courts, but it's still a rather small operation. In terms of professional societies, there's very little going on. Any discussion of long-term low-level effects as a heresy, and they don't want to hear much about it. Even the Bioelectromagnetic Society, better known as BEMS, basically use a lot of their newsletter to try and say that research, I mean, this is a research organization, yet they use their newsletter to argue that we don't even need research. So it's a rather bleak picture if you want to take this issue seriously in the United States. Michael in his introduction pointed out, once you leave here, it's very, very different. There's a completely different culture in Europe where they take this more seriously. For instance, Italy and Switzerland have adopted a fairly comprehensive and strict exposure standards, especially for new construction, say next to power lines. In England, there is what I'm calling a paradigm shift, because they are now talking, the utility is in fact talking, the national grid, the national electric utility is talking about basically buying all the houses that are too close to power lines and basically creating buffer zones. Here again, though, in the international community, there is not enough leadership in terms of taking a precautionary view. The World Health Organization has a EMF project that's run by Mike Repiccioli, and anybody who's visited my website knows that we take a rather dim view of some of his activities, although there are rules at WHO prohibiting his raising money for ministry. He seems to do it regardless. There's one standard-setting organization that dominates, ICNIRP, the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, and they also refuse to acknowledge long-term chronic risks, even though some of their leading members have been instrumental in showing that this risk is probably real. One group has emerged in recent years called ISIMS, and it has tried to create a counterbalance, if you will, to ICNIRP, and although they've had a number of meetings, they've not really successfully had the traction to meet ICNIRP head on. But even in Europe, one should add that industry plays a strong role. They have a seat at every table. The European research outfit called COST, you know, basically is run by the German wireless industry. So you know, here again, follow the money is probably a good rule. There are tremendous economic interests at every level of this debate.
Dr. Schlesen, could you summarize, please?
I will, and just say, lastly, one shouldn't neglect China and Russia, which have ongoing research, and they have very tough standards, and they stand as a counterbalance to the United States. The bottom line is, in the United States, this issue is dictated by economic interest, and there is a tremendous lack of counterbalancing leadership with respect to public health. Thank you.
Thank you for those enlightening comments. Let me just ask Steve Heilig. I think we're getting background noise. I believe you're at a conference. Can you cover the mouthpiece or something, or is there some way to reduce the sound?
That's getting I'm in a private office here. That's from.
Okay. Then somebody else is. We're getting some background noise. So if somebody is in a crowded place among the speakers, try to help us reduce that. Our last speaker is Cindy Sage. Cindy, please take us forward.
Thank you, Michael. What I'd like to speak about is what kind of precautionary actions make sense at this point in time, given what we know and what we don't know. First, to talk about power frequency fields, ELF fields, that come from things that are electric, power lines, appliances, and so on. We are at a point in the world where, or at least in the U.S., where we are looking at ELF being categorized by responsible health agencies as an IR2B, or possible carcinogen. The levels at which we have concern based on the epidemiological evidence are actually very low, 2, 3, 4, 5 milligauss, which leads us as a precautionary measure to recommend to people who ask us in the consulting world what levels should we be designing for occupancy, particularly for schools. And our view on that is that you need a 1 milligauss or less level for occupancy if you choose to have any safety factor or buffer under those levels which are suspected to increase the risk of at least childhood leukemia, possibly adult brain tumors, ALS, and some other things that you can look up on Raymond Neutra's website. So we have arrived today at a point where we suspect that ELF should be categorized as a 2B carcinogen at least, and we should be taking precautionary action for building of new schools, new homes, preschools, daycare, and so on. Now, 20 years ago, people thought this was a ridiculous notion, and yet today it's relatively well accepted, I would say, in the world where money moves, where people are putting money on large building projects and so on. A 1 or 2 milligauss limit for occupancy is really taken as a serious issue. Moving on to radio frequency, we are not there yet. We do not yet have the results of the National Toxicology Program, and we do not yet have governments and the World Health Organization saying that we are looking at a similar categorization of risk or higher level of risk. And yet there's a tremendous amount of evidence that would caution toward prudence. The kinds of things we're talking about in the consumer world would be cell phones, cordless phones, importantly, cordless phones, wireless LAN systems that may be going into your children's schools to interconnect wireless laptops, Bluetooth headsets. You may find Wi-Fi and wireless hotspots at places like Starbucks and McDonald's, places that you you take your family. You will find wireless hotspots now advertised in hotels widely. And these are all sources, as well as cell towers, wireless antenna towers, these are all sources of radio frequency radiation that at the moment we suspect may create bioeffects and potentially adverse health effects that we should be responding to as a community of people interested in health. We have on our website, and you will have on Che's website, a number of things that people can do to educate themselves and to understand what levels of exposure may potentially be bioactive. 5 years ago, cell phones were operating at well under the existing limits, such as they are. They are thermal limits. That which burns you hurts you. And today we know that they are probably not safe, and that we're looking at levels of exposure 1,000 times lower for cell phones, which are perhaps likely to be harmful. In the last 2 years, we have seen studies published around the world on wireless antenna sites or cell sites, and we are now dropping another 1,000-fold lower, where we are seeing detectable adverse health consequences reported widespread in populations in countries around the world. There does not appear to be a way to live or work or go to school within a couple of hundred meters of a typical macrocell or wireless cell site and not have effects such as insomnia, impairment in thinking or cognitive function, spatial disorientation, irritability, mood disorders and anxiety, vertigo, dizziness, tinnitus, importantly, and immune system dysfunction. So very briefly then, we are at a point in time where we know enough to be careful, and we need to be able to identify and to discuss with people symptoms that may be related to radio frequency and microwave exposures.
Thank you very much, Cindy. And I'll take our first question before we open the lines from Dr. Elihu Richter at Hebrew University. Dr. Richter, your comments.
Well, let me make some very brief comments. I have a love-hate relationship with radio frequency microwave because radio frequency microwave serves as the eyes and ears of our country in defending itself. And I am projecting to the other speaker, to the very distinguished speakers, the ambivalent attitude of many of my patients who come to me with brain tumors from very, very high occupational exposures associated with the handling, manufacture, and use of such technology, especially in military security settings. Now, one of the things that I've felt is that these risks have been grossly under investigated. As we look at the literature, the few studies that exist are far from adequate. They are, where the numbers are large, there are major problems with exposure misclassification. The follow-up is pure. It's not very, very good. The subgroups are not properly analyzed and so on and so forth. We get back to John Goldsmith's classic observation that when you read the papers carefully, there's a discrepancy between what the results seem to be suggesting and what the conclusions are and the conclusions that are presented by the authors. There's a disconnect there. What do we do? I would like to see much more investigation of suspect clusters in community settings. A cluster, as epidemiologists know, is a numerator looking for a denominator. And many, many community groups are reporting such clusters. We don't know whether we are dealing with Texas sharpshooter kinds of scenarios or the real thing. So there's a much greater need for epidemiologists to go and look at these clusters coming in with a hypothesis of exposure. The second business has to do with the fact that we have a basic science problem. We're in a whole new ballgame here. We're not dealing with classic dose-response models. There are window effects, resonance effects, and the like. We don't know what the biologically active parameters are. Are they peak exposures, transients, average exposures, special frequencies, and so on and so forth? We have to start collecting much more data using methods such as spectrum analysis. Are simple mean exposures really just an artifact of the way we summarize data, or do they tell us something for real? These are just some of the questions. But these questions should not deter us from the case for action. I totally endorse all the recommendations for precautionary and even for precautionary strategies to reduce exposures at the source. Are we dealing here with the new lead problem? Lead crept upward over the decades. And it took an awful lot of pain and suffering to disentangle the fact that exposures that were considered normal, in fact, were in fact toxic. Are we dealing with the same kind of scenario here with the various frequencies of exposure to radio frequency, ELF, and the rest? I don't know.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I suspect we are, by the way.
I really appreciate the comments. We all do. Eleni, could you open the lines for us, and we'll start to hear from the partners.
Yes, operator, if you can please put everyone in talk listen mode and let us know when you've done that would be wonderful. And I'd also like to remind folks in the meantime that we do have a live weblog up at the moment. If you'd like to post a question or a comment, you don't need special software to get to the blog. You just go to our website at www.healthandenvironment.org, and then you click on the What's New box, the first item about this call. Just click on that link under the What's New box, and it will take you to the page that includes the link to the blog. And we do have some comments and questions. So, Michael, let me know when you'd like to feel.
All lines are now open.
Thank you.
Okay, let's take a few live questions first. Who would like to begin?
Dr. Roy Ozan, I have a question.
Please proceed and make it brief, please.
Yeah. I've seen some patients with serious problems. They've done better by limiting exposure to fields. They have taught me to look for high-frequency electric fields as the most damaging, and I heard talk about magnetic fields with milligauss. Any comments about the differences between high-frequency electric fields, low-frequency electric fields, and the magnetic field?
Which speaker feels most prepared to respond to that question?
Maybe Michael Kunde is speaking. Maybe
yes.
I can start with answering this question. We have high-frequency fields that are modulated, and the modulation is a low-frequency one. Look at, for example, the mobile phones of the GSM standard. They are modulated at 217 hertz, and they have also 8 hertz components, so they are low-frequency modulated. The whole research area in the high-frequency range started by experiments that used high-frequency fields to put low-frequency radiation into the body, because at high levels of low-frequency fields you get spark discharge, and so you can have higher exposure to low-frequency if you modulate it to high-frequency fields. So there is some evidence that low-frequency modulated high-frequency fields have much the same effect as low-frequency fields themselves.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to just take one answer per question. Let's have the next partner question, please.
This is Vinny Gary.
Yeah?
I've been reading lately about an association between acoustic neuroma and electromagnetic fields, particularly relative to the phone sets that the kids are using these days. That's one. Second question. How come I don't ever see birds hanging around high-power wires?
Okay, I'm going to turn to Lou Slesson on this because I've seen some things on your website about those studies. Lou?
The acoustic neuroma data is what I would call extremely provocative. It first came out of Sweden, part of the multi-country Interphone study, and they found a statistically significant increase in acoustic neuroma after long-term, that is after 10 years or more of use. A second group out of Örebro University, led by Dr. Leonard Hardell, has published two different papers, two different sets of data, as it were, that seems also to find this long-term risk. It's still small numbers, and it's still, it's not a done deal, but it is, as I would say, provocative and needs real attention, and we need to do more to understand whether or not this is a real association.
Do you have a comment on the birds, Lou?
I don't, actually.
Okay. Next question, please.
The same thing here in Israel.
Next question, please.
Boiling bars in the state of Virginia. I have aberrant electric fields from old house wiring, less than 2 milligauss, causing me muscle spasms, pain, and weakness, and flu-like symptoms. Do I have any choices for protection or healing?
Cindy Sage, would you respond to that, please?
Yeah, a remediation in a home like that, at least in our experience, you can reduce magnetic fields down to something at 1 or 2 or 3 tenths of a milligauss. And we do have a subset, a small number of people who report feeling illness at even 2 milligauss. And at that point, perhaps you have entered into the world of electrosensitivity, where you do respond to lower and lower fields than the larger population. But that is in almost all cases, unless it's power line as its source, is correctable.
And how can I find out more about that?
I'm going to have to, you can go to Cindy's website as a start. I want to keep the questions coming from different people, but listed on our resource, SAGE website, will give you some information on that.
Michael, I'd like to pose a question from
someone on
the blog.
Yeah.
Person asked, Diane Henschel is on the line, and she asks, what information is there on the impacts of low-level chronic exposure we are now getting from wireless routers?
Raymond Neutra, would you like to take a shot at that?
Probably Cindy's better than.
Cindy?
Yes, I can. We've actually measured a number of wireless routers that we installed in our office for test purposes, and almost all of them will produce a detectable and measurable radio frequency field that would envelop you in RF radiation as you sit at that desk. So we recommend that you stick with straight Ethernet Cat 5 cable and continue to look for a linking system, a router that does not have a wireless connect.
If I may add something there, Michael. When I ordered my cable modem, it came with the wireless router. And it took me half an hour on the phone with the company to disable it, but you can disable it if you so choose. If you decide to continue with it, one thing to do is maybe to put it in a back room or somewhere and not, as Cindy just said wisely, to put it on your desk next to where you work.
Thank you. Next question,
Diane,
please.
Wait. This is Diane. I have a question to ask about that because we don't have choices anymore. As she pointed out earlier, you know, the wireless routers are everywhere. I'm at a university. The wireless routers are now in every single building, and it envelops you everywhere. So what is the data on it? I mean, you're just talking about measurements. How about any impact?
Comment on that from any of our speakers?
Well, the level at which you're probably exposed as you're working within an office might be maybe 20 to 60 nanowatts per centimeter squared, which is, it's a legal number, but it doesn't mean it isn't making people sick. We've recommended that universities, colleges, and other school districts provide a wireless-free work environment for those people who are adversely affected, and it's simply a matter of your lobbying and presenting information to make that demand sound reasonable. And you will find others who will need that environment as well to work productively.
Other questions, please?
Jeff Anderson. This is for Cindy Sage or anyone else. Practical question. How does anyone locate cell transmitter equipment in their particular communities or neighborhoods?
Well, if you're talking about wireless cell sites on towers, that's
yes.
One thing. If you're talking about access points in a building, a hotel, or a school room, which is it that you want?
The former.
Cell towers will tell you what. If you contact me, I'll send you a lot of digital photos that will show you what to look for. And there are two kinds. You'll find them on towers, and you will also find them hidden as stealth installations on buildings.
Right.
In that case, you would need a very small detector to put in your pocket and walk around with that beeps when you're within, a couple tenths of a microwatt of, or a couple of hundred
right.
feet from such a facility.
Okay, I'll contact you for the details. Thank you.
I'd like to pose a question to Dr. Kundi, who we will probably hear less frequently from. So while you're with us, first of all, thank you for the wonderful quality of your research and your contributions to the field. I understand, and it's come up on the call, that this is not a dose makes the poison situation, that as with chemical contaminants, we now find that lower levels of some of these fields can have greater impacts than higher levels of some of these fields, among many other points. Since this development is taking place both in our understanding of how chemical contaminants affect us and how these fields affect us, do we understand why there are these parallels, or are they being studied as completely separate phenomena? And finally, what about the interactions between chemical contaminants and EMF fields?
Well, that's a very interesting question, or many questions indeed. First of all, it is correct that if you go to very sensitive endpoints and you go to very low intensities, you find also in chemical factors, but also in electromagnetic fields, some peculiar reactions that you have at very low exposures, you have greater effects at higher ones. One hypothesis is that at lower exposure, the cell reacts to this exposure, but the protective mechanisms are not invoked. So the protective mechanisms that are evoked at higher levels reduce the response, and because of the lack of this protective exposure at lower levels, you get an effect. So this is one of the hypotheses that are put forward to explain these peculiar dose-response relationships. But there are also other hypotheses. I won't go into detail concerning this aspect. But for high-frequency electromagnetic field, there's another very important point that at high exposures you get so-called thermal effects. You get heating, and this heating has effects of its own. And at low exposures, you also have a molecular effect that can be associated with heating, but grossly speaking, you have no detectable heating. Nevertheless, the field is there and may have an effect that is different from the effect of heating. So in the experiment, we have to avoid this heating, and this poses certain experimental problems. But what was the other question?
The other question was about the interaction of chemical and EMF effects.
Yes, this is also very important, because we think at the moment that if electromagnetic fields in the high frequency range have an effect at all, it might be a promotive effect. If it is a promotive effect, then together with a chemical carcinogen, for example, you would have an enhanced effect. And many scientists have pointed out already that promoters are by far more dangerous than initiating agents, because every deviating clone is promoted, and many people might suffer during their lifetime of malignant disease. So we have, I think, sort of change of paradigm in the cancer society, that promoters deserve by far more scrutiny to investigate them. And they should be looked at not just as another agent that needs to be taken into consideration, but we should focus on them.
Thank you very much. Other questions, please?
Yeah, Dr. Bill Ray from Dallas, Texas.
Yes, welcome, Dr. Ray. We appreciate your work.
Thank you. We've probably treated over 1,000 electrically sensitive patients, and one thing we've noticed is that there's a extremely strong relationship between pesticides and electromagnetic sensitivity. And I wondered if any of you knew anybody that was doing any research on that.
This is Dr. Neutra. Hi, Dr. Ray.
Hi, Ray.
We did a study in a random survey of Californians in which we asked them about whether or not they had electrical sensitivity and chemical sensitivity. And there was an overlap. It was, if one said that one was sensitive to chemicals, one was about 3 times more likely to say that one was sensitive to electrical appliances. But there were people who were sensitive to electrical appliances that did not have chemical sensitivity.
True.
So there's an association, but it's not a perfect one, at least on the basis of self-report.
We would
agree. Other questions, please.
This is Pedro Badolf. I'm calling
Beta.
California.
Welcome. Yes.
And I'm just wondering, is there a major study out there that just isn't being that deals with the health issues, and it's not being paid? No one's paying attention to that, or is there a need for a major study in order to get folks' attention?
Well, that's a very important question, and there are many people who could answer that. But we've heard less from Lewis Flesson for a few minutes. Lewis.
I'm not sure what it takes to motivate attention on this issue, but you would think the IARC designation of EMF being a 2B carcinogen would motivate some interest. especially in the government. The Swedish data on cell phones and acoustic neuroma, and there's also talk about you know, a link to brain tumors. You know, this is hardly, you know, it's hardly causing a ripple. And so, you know, I have to say that I'm at a loss to know what will motivate people to you know, other than, you know, the public rising up and demanding some kind of action. I you know, I'm at a total loss to understand why the public health community refuses to take this issue seriously.
So, but to Beta Badoff's question of whether there is a major existing study that people aren't paying attention to, or whether we need a specific area of study. If you were, say, guiding, you know, private philanthropy in this area toward what really needs to be done, not at the level of governmental investment, but at the level of private philanthropy investment, what would you recommend?
Well, I think...
May I just add some sentences to what Luis said?
Yes,
before?
Please.
Luis said in his in his presentation that the FDA, the U.S. FDA, has some years ago started to recommend animal study, and FDA is now looking over the evidence and is commenting on that. And what puzzles me is that they dismiss all studies that find an effect on grounds that are not scientifically justified. For example, they commented on the Hardell study that was published 2 months or so ago, that this study had some problems, methodological ones, and all material statements they made were wrong. And
Dr. Kundi, forgive me, but we're right about at the end of the call here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So
I wanted to say...
Can I ask one more question?
You'll have to hold the other question. Just let Dr. Kundi wrap up here.
I just wanted to say that there was some awareness in the United States, and I think that this has stopped now for some reason or the other, and I'm very sorry about that.
Let me just throw in one thing to answer the question posed, and that is what we need to understand is how these fields do their damage and how they cause the effect. Until we have a handle on that, we're not going to get very far, in my view.
Okay. I'm going to just take very brief final comments. We've heard from Dr. Kundi and Dr. Slesson. Dr. Neutra, brief final comment.
Michael, we have 6 minutes.
Oh, we have six minutes. I'm so glad. I apologize to you all. My clock is fast in Brussels, so...
Can I ask a question about
then
what...
Let's go for more questions. My apologies.
What people recommend on the panel about what actions they actually would like to see people take at, for example, a local government level? I don't
Cindy Sage, why don't you respond to that question?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah.
At the moment in California, there's a Senate bill that would preempt any remaining local agency ability to govern where new cell towers are placed. We have very limited ability to, we can only comment now on visual and land use compatibility issues, but not on radio frequency health issues, having been preempted by the federal government. If you want to comment on SB 1627, Senate Bill 1627, I urge you to do it, because if this passes, what will happen is that we'll have absolutely no voice at the city or county level in California about cell towers going on schools or near residences.
Cindy, while you're speaking about that, what is the status of the federal process for allowing transmissions through house electrical systems? You've spoken to that before, but could you describe that and say where that stands?
Yeah, this is an equally important issue. We are about, the California Public Utility Commission has now approved what's called broadband over power lines, which is the provision of radio frequency wireless internet coming in on every single electrical system to every building in California. If you're a ratepayer and you pay an electric bill, you will have involuntary exposure to this form of radio frequency very soon. And I would predict, as others do, this would be tremendously damaging, and you would have no choice.
Thank you. Other questions, please?
I have one. How do you deal with the, how do you address the claim by the cell phone people that many, many more antennas placed in more and more situations means lower exposures in the near field, even though you have higher exposures in the far field?
Anybody want to speak to that?
Well, I think the point is that as long as we are continuing to see that the scientific studies identify lower and lower nanowatts per centimeter squared level fields being bioactive, none of it can be said to be more healthy or more acceptable.
Right.
Michael, I have a quick comment and question.
Yes, go ahead.
And this is...
Do you want to identify yourself?
Yeah, this is Dr. Roy Ozan again.
Right.
We have all the talk about cancer again and again, and it is a late-stage effect. The patients that I see have huge physiologic changes from lower, from these exposures. For instance, blood sugar levels are very affected by exposure to these sort of dirty frequencies that come in on your 60 cycle. And so I think we need some research that doesn't just focus on cancer effects again.
Yes, may I comment on this?
Yes, please.
The problem is these studies, there are only three studies worldwide published until now that have taken other endpoints instead of cancer into consideration with respect to high-frequency radiation, especially from mobile phones. So there is a lack of scientific work done in this area, and I would also recommend to look at other endpoints.
Thank you.
I'd like to make a recommendation as regard to the knowledge the Chinese medical system has on the bioelectric properties of the body and how that might give us some information here in the West about the health effects and how to protect the body, because the Chinese system is a vibrational system, and it's a little bit differently organized than the Western system, to be sure, but may hold some answers for us.
Thank you for that comment. Other comments or questions, please?
Yeah.
Yes. I would like to see some support for investigation of clusters in which there is real microanalysis of the exposures on a meter-by-meter or a meter-by-meter basis using careful spectral analysis techniques and GIS techniques so that we have really good mapping in relation to the cases, mapping of exposures in relation to the cases.
Let me add, Louis Sutton, there's a fascinating cluster investigation ongoing now in Australia, in Melbourne, and I would urge anyone who's interested just to put RMIT, that's the name of the university where the cluster was found, in Google News, and you get a whole lot of stories, and it's really worth a look because it shows you how these clusters are actually dealt with, and or I might say not dealt with, and it's a kind of ongoing thing as we speak.
Eleni, did you have something you wanted to say here, or something?
Yes, we're about 30 seconds out before the top of the hour, so I don't think.
Okay, why don't you go ahead? But let me just thank all of our speakers and thank the CHE partners. Clearly, this is an area of tremendous both concern and interest. And I would simply encourage all CHE partners who want to track this to join the EMF working group. We are growing. We've taken a year to be very careful before we did this call. We've clearly identified some of the top people nationally and internationally in this field. And I think this partner call will stimulate us to hold more EMF working group calls where we can pursue the many questions that CHE partners have in this area and help move the whole field forward. So thank you all, and Eleni, I'll leave it to you to wrap the call up.
Thanks, Michael. And I just also want to mention that we do have an interview with Cindy Sage on the homepage of the website that's up for folks if they want to read it, and also to remind folks that there are several resources on the website regarding today's call if they'd like to look those up. And if they have any questions, please feel free to email me at Eleni, E-L-E-N-I, at healthandenvironment.org. But we thank everyone for participating, and we especially thank the presenters for a terrific call, and we look forward to talking with you next month when our next call will focus on the green economy. Take care, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Bye, all.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi. Hello? 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 Hello, Judy?